Our keynote speaker this morning is Dr. David Farrier from the University of Edinburgh. He teaches contemporary literature there. And he's the author of monographs on 19th century and early 20th century Pacific travel writing and on representations of asylum seekers and refugees in contemporary literature, visual art and film. And David also convenes the Environmental Humanities Network in Edinburgh. And his next project will be a book on deep time and contemporary poetry. So we're really excited to have him here today, talking about Chloe Hooper's book, A Child's Book of True Crime.
Thanks, thanks Emily and to everyone on the committee for putting this on and for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here to see you all, and hope it's not too early in the morning for thinking about what I'm about to talk about. Tim Flannery's seminal work of environmental history, The Future Eaters, ends with a brief afterword that is both curiously evocative and disruptive of the tropes of crime fiction. From his desk, Flannery describes the elegant expanse of Sydney Harbour stretching away before him. It's a charming scene with, he says, blue waters interweaving with the green of parks and suburbs, and it gives rise to a gentle reflection on the arrival of the First Fleet 200 years earlier. Underlying his meditation, however, Flannery notes a hidden presence that is perhaps a bit more sinister. Somewhere near me lies the grave of Arabanu, who was buried with so much care and regard by Governor Phillip all those years ago. I cannot visit his grave, for it is unmarked, the exact location now being lost. Somewhere behind me, far to the west, great machines drone on, converting forest into yet more suburbs and cropland. Arabanu was a member of the Manly tribe and the first Indigenous Australian to live with the British settlers, having been kidnapped and imprisoned in 1788 in order to serve as an interpreter. He died of smallpox in May of the following year, and this invisible bodily invasion sets up a kind of subterranean echo in Flannery's passage, in which Arabanu's remains are now also invisible, out of sight. Further echoes resound in the unseen violence done to the forests to the west. Although, Flannery says, like Arabanu's grave, I cannot see the machines, I know they are there, because the vista afforded him by his vantage point is not only the charms of Sydney Harbour, of the charms of Sydney Harbour, but also of the vast parasite state where the spoils go, he says. Flannery's suggestion of sinister acts, only partially occluded by the splendour of the cityscape, calls to my mind the scene in Ian Rankin's The Falls, when the detective John Rebus surveys Edinburgh from the peak of Arthur's Seat and sees only a crime scene waiting to happen. Since the L.A. Noir of Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, we have become perhaps familiar with the figure of the jaded detective who senses crime everywhere. In other ways, however, Flannery's vista provides a notable departure, most significantly in that it is a crime scene without a body. Indeed, it's barely even a discrete scene, as the damage occurs far away and out of sight, and in some senses out of time as well. They are nonetheless intimately connected with the scene Flannery sees in front of him, the cityscape, the parasite state sustained by these various kinds of violence. Not only bodiliness then, but dispersed, and at the same time intimately connected. All crimes are, in some respects, relational acts. They represent ruptures in some relations, and they create new relations in their place. But the notion of a crime that lacks a singular body or location points, I think, to the peculiarities of ecological damage or harm as a kind of crime. In Chris Jordan's famous series of photographs of dead lace and albatross on Midway Island, each desiccated bird reveals a stomach that is livid with plastics. It's recently been suggested that seabirds eat marine plastic because it acquires a patina of algae that gives off a smell that's very similar to krill. And if that's so, it's rather ironic that many of the birds who've ingested this plastic have died from starvation, their blocked digestive systems unable to absorb sufficient nutrients. Now, unlike Flannery's scene, Jordan's photographs certainly do give us a body. But the scene of the crime is much more difficult to pin down. Almost all Leys and albatross live either on Midway or the surrounding atolls, which lie in the centre of the North Pacific Gyre, a mobile concentration of over 100 million tonnes of thermoplastic fragments, many only millimetres in diameter. Leys and albatross range across an area of 15 million square miles, or thereabouts, and the Pacific Ocean itself has an area of around 64 million square miles, in which a number of these plastic gyres circulate. The plastic the albatross consume comes not just from as far afield as Japan and Australia that bound the Pacific Ocean, but also from international shipping. So this bird in particular might have ingested Indonesian and Norwegian plastics, which derived from oil fields in the Arabian Gulf or Brazil, and were processed in China in order to profit American businesses. Given this potentially astonishing distribution of cause and effect, of multiple scenes converging on the one particular animal death, what really constitutes here the scene of the crime, as it were? So in this paper, I want to respond to Rob Nixon's assertion that literary writing plays a role in giving shape to the formlessness of what he calls slow violence, the non-spectacular forms of harm that exceed our efforts to contain and to visualise them, to give them a shape and a form. Species decline is a good example of, I think, non-spectacular violence. We typically need very specialised frameworks of knowledge in order to see it, as it were. The challenge of extinction is that, as Deborah Bird Rose has said, we are forced to understand our situatedness differently, our situatedness in the context of this mass dispersal. She posits the emergence of what she calls Anthropocene Noir to frame this problem of situatedness. We, human beings, she says, are all criminals, all detectives, and all victims. That's the situatedness of the Anthropocene. Everyone is contributing, everyone is affected, everyone is part of it. Now, I think I know what you're thinking at this point. These might seem rather problematic terms. The Anthropocene in particular is a term that many people feel, to say the least, cautious about. As Alistair Rawls and Deborah Walker have observed, noir as a critical term has been used so frequently with so many meanings and applications that it's become almost unusable as a critical term. And a similar but much more dangerous imprecision has been suggested by critics of the Anthropocene, from Alf Hornberg and Andreas Malm's observation that it flattens structural inequalities, it doesn't pay attention to the kind of unevenness that is both a contributing factor to and a consequence of what we sometimes call the Anthropocene. To Eileen Crist's assertion that the term Anthropocene crystallises human domination, it forces all the attention back on to the human, not onto the human in the context of capitalism or the human in the context of multi-species relations. However, I think Rawls is actually very careful not to flatten the picture in the way that some critics have spoken of in terms of the Anthropocene. The we of the Anthropocene she's talking about here includes not just all humans, but all beings bound up in the dynamic, fragile systems that sustain life. Guilt, suffering, and responsibility are by no means equally distributed, and in the case of suffering, not equally so between humans and non-human others. The primary human casualties of the Anthropocene are and will continue to be indigenous peoples, small island nations, and the global poor who bear the cost of the developed world's carbon largesse. But Rose says, while it's manifestly true that we are not all situated identically, no situatedness is granted immunity. Rather, we are all tangled up in trouble. And it's this entanglement, I think, that makes noir such a productive context for thinking about the Anthropocene in these terms. As Stephen Knight has observed, uncertainty is contemporary crime fiction's dominant principle. An Anthropocene noir is therefore, I think, aligned with what some critics call the discontinuous tradition in crime fiction, associated with the social critique of writers like Chandler and Hamnet, in which the forces of disorder are not limited to a single criminal actor, but distributed throughout society. There's a sense in a lot of this kind of LA noir that the city itself is saturated with criminality, with acts of violence and transgression, a sense of an endemic problem. Or perhaps, as Rose herself puts it, missed one. Oh, there we are. Consider the classic noir protagonist. He or she is part criminal, part detective, part victim. Everyone is guilty, and shared guilt is a common bond. That is exactly our condition today. We are all tangled up in political, cultural, and economic systems we know to be destructive. Of course, we are guilty. We participate in actions that damage the earth. Yes, in some sense, we are criminals. We seek to understand the coercive bonds that entangle us in systems of damage, and so, yes, we are detectives trying to figure out what is going on, really. And we are now suffering, and in future will suffer more deeply, the effects of all this damage. We are victims too. And of course, we have to bear in mind here that the we is a very inclusive one, and a one that takes account of multiple forms of unevenness and inequality, but also the dense entanglement that situates that unevenness. So in the Anthropocene, there is no single body, culprit or scene by which to definitively identify and isolate global ecological harms or crimes. While the spectre of climate change is already acting upon indigenous peoples and denizens of the global south, its distinct bodiliness, its material effects, the way in which it acts upon bodies, has a presence, lacks nonetheless a particular body. Delocalized in their causes, incalculable and potentially irredeemable in their effects, the Anthropocene and associated extinction crises are compelling examples, I think, of what Ulrich Beck calls global risks, anticipated catastrophes which cannot be delimited spatially, temporally, or socially. So I want to propose that in Chloe Hooper's novel, A Child's Book of True Crime, we can encounter Anthropocene noir as a form of ironic crime fiction, which explores the ambivalent relation between individual animal death and species death. Hooper's protagonist is Kate Byrne, a Tasmanian schoolteacher who's having an affair with Thomas, the father of her most able pupil. She becomes increasingly convinced that Thomas's wife, Veronica, plans to have revenge upon her for this affair by reenacting the violent murder of a local girl, Ellie Siddle, who 12 years earlier was having an affair and was thought to have been murdered by her lover's vengeful wife. Veronica is a true crime author whose most recent work, Murder at Black Swan Point, investigated Ellie's unsolved death, and Kate attempts to understand and to an extent manage her fear by writing a children's version of the story with local fauna, including the extinct Thylacine, as the detectives. Shadowing Kate's account of the Siddle murder and her own affair is her preoccupation with the area's brutal colonial history and the endangered status of its wildlife. As an instance of crime fiction defined by uncertainty, Hooper's novel depicts animal death as a crime without a singular scene, culprit, or victim. Bodiless but prolific with corpses, seamless but occurring always, everywhere. Yet it also contains the potential to realise, albeit tentatively, an interspecies variation on what Beck calls the cosmopolitan moment, in which previously ignored others are involved in the response that follows the disaster. Casting herself simultaneously in the roles of detective and imaginatively victim and culprit, Kate's child's book extends the same proliferation of roles to the non-human, albeit rather ironically anthropomorphized actors in her story. And it's this dynamic, I think, that sets up a reading of this novel as a kind of Anthropocene noir. So, the so-called golden age of detective fiction, the era of Agatha Christie, George Simmel, and so on, tended to present criminality as a form of narrative expiation, a means of describing criminal acts as isolated from society and therefore understandable, containable. It can be aligned, I think, with the function of literary comedy in the same way, in that the orientation of the narrative is towards resolution, the restoration of a kind of social order. For Franco Moretti, the form relies upon the narrative's capacity to represent the crime as unique and therefore separate, containable. The perfect crime, he says, the nightmare of detective fiction, is the featureless, de-individualised crime that anyone could have committed. Kate's narrative subtly undermines this convention by compulsively asserting a correspondence between herself and Ellie Siddle. Both attended a girls-only school from age 4 to 18. During assignations with her lover Thomas, Kate imagines him to be Dr. Graham Harvey, Ellie's lover and the husband of her supposed murderer, Margot. Thomas's wet fingers started to unbutton my shirt, just as she imagines how Harvey would unbutton Ellie's blouse one button at a time with wet fingers. I understood Ellie, she says, because I gave her my own story. She kind of restages both scenes in the same terms. Kate's flexible identification with other characters in her narrative and that of the original crime isn't limited to the victim, however. In a triangulation of transgressions, she imagines she's better able to identify with Veronica, the author, she says, of her own textbook on how to kill one's rival, when she gave Margot Veronica's face. In all this, Kate occupies imaginatively the roles of victim, murderer, and detective, a conflation that I think has several consequences. First, it stresses the way that representations of gender-based violent crime in particular come to form a kind of recognisable vocabulary that plays a role in normalising that violence. Inside all the true crime books were the same photographs, Kate observes. Publishers must have recycled them, alternating what others from their, quote, doomed girl series. And effectively, I think what Hooper's novel is dramatising is the way in which her protagonist awakens gradually to the normalisation of a range of interrelated forms of violence, gendered, colonial, multi-species, the way in which these kind of violence become just accepted, just part of the scene, uninterrogated. Furthermore, in shuttling between an imaginative recollection of a past crime, Ellie's death, and her anticipation of a similar crime in the near future, the one that she feels she might be subject to, Kate conjures a rather anthropocenic sense of the crime as dispersed. On the one hand, this dispersed sensibility connects Kate's fear of Veronica's retribution with a latent sense of the violence underpinning colonial history. Her narrative unfolds in a haunted, even psychopathologized landscape of, she says, Rorschach cliffs swollen with history. Echoing Rosalind Smith's assertion that the centrality of true crime and its narrations to formations of Australian identity, Kate notes that our local history is the true crime story. So colonial history is the beginning of both Australian national identity and the kind of true crime story that accompanies it, in her perspective. Yet the early colony's chronic brutality is softened beyond recognition by the tourism industry. We sweetened history by making fudge on the site of the brutal female factory, she notes. And in the case of the genocide of the indigenous population, almost entirely erased. If Hooper draws on the tradition of what Marcus Clarke calls weird melancholy in her depictions of the Australian landscape, she does so with a keen sense that much of this melancholy power emanates from the indigenous population's absence and dispossession. This aspect of Hooper's novel is a reminder that post-colonial literary crime fiction typically uses elements of the genre for social rather than criminal detective, as it were, as a means of recognising historical oppressions. But where this sense of dispersal also points to future crimes, the crimes that Kate is afraid will be enacted upon her, it forms a link with Beck's theory of risk that I mentioned earlier. 21st century risk societies are, Beck says, defined by their accommodation, their normalisation of anticipated catastrophes. Manufactured disasters, such as altering the climate, that are the unintended side effects of technological and economic development. In the world risk society that emerges from this dependence on the capacity to absorb dangers rather than avert them, risk becomes at once delocalised, incalculable, and non-compensable, as Beck puts it. A schema which corresponds, I think, with ecological crime in the Anthropocene and with the current extinction crisis in particular. Significantly, Anthropocene noir emphasises, I think, one key convention in detective fiction. So on the one hand, the conservative impulse to exonerate society by maintaining the culpability of a single criminal actor is broken in Anthropocene noir. But it is impossible to ascribe a single motive or intention to anthropogenic ecological crimes. No one, or very few people, deliberately set out to harm the planet. There aren't that many people out there with a real animus against polar bears, I think. Yet while the criminal is a newly dispersed element in ecological detective fiction, the spectrality of the detective, a feature which, as Lee Horsley argues, reaches back to Sherlock Holmes, is preserved, even enhanced. The detective is traditionally a liminal figure, poised like Chief Inspector Heat and Joseph Conrad's The Secret Agent, between the forces of order and disorder. And this is a consequence not only of the detective's social function as a kind of barrier between society and the forces of criminality, the forces of disorder, a kind of gatekeeper or guard, but also their narrative function. In Svetan Todorov's scheme, a detective fiction is typically organised into two strands. There are two stories at play in any detective narrative. The absent but real story of the crime and the present but secondary story of the detection. So the narrative of detection, according to Todorov, is always secondary to the crime that it reconstructs. It is the crime that is the real story of the detective narrative, as it were. And within this real story, the detective is a kind of spectral figure haunting the scene of the absent principal narrative, the story of the crime, and a prism for the reader through which the fragmented original events are projected and reassembled. Think about the typical denouement of any Agatha Christie or story or episode of Columbo or even Scooby-Doo. There's always a moment when what happened prior to the narrative, prior to the discovery of the body, is reconstituted, told again, put back together, as it were, reassembled. Ironically then, while Anthropocene Noir deconstructs the role of the criminal, dispersing criminality everywhere, it accentuates a key feature of the detective to evoke the ghostly and dispersed nature of the crime. And furthermore, this irony highlights how the roles of criminal, victim, and detective in Anthropocene Noir are not equally distributed themselves, a crucial distinction that is, in turn, further highlighted by the roles given to the animals in Hooper's novel. So A Child's Book of True Crime is especially notable for the fact that the narrative is full of dead animals. And the images here are, they accompany the text as at the head of the extracts that are meant to represent Kate's child's book. I think they're meant to represent drawings that her pupils have made as part of their school project on endangered wildlife. A terrible spray of red across the bitumen was somehow connected to the long furry tail of a wallaby. The images of kangaroos in bullet hole riddled road signs, their paws held up in rigor mortis, lay like forgotten crime victims by the edge of the road. A pub is decorated with mounted shark's jaws and the memorabilia of long-wrecked whaling ships. Invited to draw an endangered species, one child draws a family of blind koalas, all hanging limp from a tree, ravaged by skin cancer and chlamydia. Kate hears the story of a convict whose escape attempt involved wrapping himself in the fur of a dead kangaroo, and of escaped bushranger, Michael Howe, who in 1818 made himself a book out of kangaroo skin in which to write his dreams of slaughtered animals and slaughtered enemies alike. Each specific animal death in Hooper's narrative is implicitly connected to a culture of invisibility surrounding animal death in general. Between the lines of every story there is, she says, another story which always has to be imagined, written in blood. It is widespread animal death on a scale which it exceeds the capacity to imagine, to give shape and form to, that occupies, I think, the place of the absent but real story of the crime in Kate's narrative. Her response to her own dilemma, her sense of vulnerability and threat, and implicitly to the extinction crisis which shadows it, is to produce, as I've said, her own child's book of true crime. Fascinated by the lateral logic displayed by the children in her class in their approach to learning about endangered species, her child's book is an attempt to make sense of the incalculable scale and urgency of multiscalar past and future hauntings. Free from the constraints of adult reason, Kate's pupils possess an ambivalent morality. One child, Henry, cannot differentiate from crime from punishment. The worst thing, he says, would be to go to jail after shooting someone. Yet this ambivalence enhances rather than limits the effectiveness of her narrative as a mode of Anthropocene Noir. When Eliza, another pupil, writes a project on the Tasmanian tiger, a curious blurring of temporalities is implied. Past and present tenses merged, we're told. It was unclear whether the animal was endangered or extinct. Problems. People shot all the Tasmanian tigers because they ate their chickens. Solutions. If anyone finds any tigers, they should be put in a zoo. Hooper's implied assertion is that both Henry's elision of crime and punishment and Eliza's wandering tenses are not only indicative of immature reasoning, but of a sense of an underlying connection between things that formerly were distinct. Children understand intuitively the interconnectedness of unlikely narrative strands, Kate says. What writing the child's book allows her to do is start to put together the suppressed relationships between the forms of violence that the novel is preoccupied with: gendered violence, colonial violence, and multi-species violence. And her choice of true crime is also, I think, significant. Smith notes that true crime as a subgenre of crime writing is typically more at ease than conventional crime fiction with things like a lack of resolution, open-endedness, the unavailability of objective distance, and the presence of multiple unresolved histories behind the foregrounded crime. Hooper's thylacine detective, Terence Tiger, who was a kind of parallel protagonist in this story, concedes the unfortunate truth of true crime is that often there is no ending. And as Rose makes clear, Anthropocene Noir indicates the story without a known ending. In the account it presents of damages that are both highly dispersed and deeply entangled, the ultimate consequences of which are subject to a profound and enduring uncertainty, Kate's child's book of true crime opens up, I think, the narrative possibilities of Anthropocene Noir, and it's no more evident, I think, in this novel than when it comes to the thylacine detective himself, Terence Tiger. So ultimately, Kate realises that by searching the story of Ellie Siddle's murder for clues to Veronica's possibly murderous plans, she misinterprets the nature of risk. "The girl dies whichever way you play it," she says. "Knowing who the murderer had been wouldn't keep me safe." And Ulrich Beck says that the irony of risk is that relying on past experience encourages anticipation of the wrong kind of risk, the one we believe we can calculate and control, whereas the disaster arises from what we do not know and cannot calculate. As Beck puts it, the narrative of risk is a narrative of irony. And this is most strikingly and destructively evident in the animal detectives that populate Kate's child's book. In contrast to their willingness to solve human crimes, they're a kind of, they're a kind of Scooby gang in that sense. They're kind of quasi-heroic and benign figures. But in contrast to their willingness to respond to transgressions against humans in the story, multiple foul and bloody deeds are committed against them, we're told. Kingsley Kookaburra, described as an experienced psychological profiler, is reduced by habitat loss to raiding suburban goldfish ponds. The family of psychic detective Warwick Wallaby experienced dreadful luck with feral cats and cars. Hooper's text is particularly focused, I think, on the imperiled situation of Australian wildlife, where rates of endemic mammal extinctions account for around 35% of the global extinction rate. Australia's lost around 30 mammals since European settlement to extinction, which is in stark contrast, I think, to the rate of around 1 to 2 animals in other parts of the world. But this is, of course, also indicative of a looming planetary collapse in biodiversity. But the key link to the current extinction crisis is Terence Tiger, the thylacine detective. The thylacine is perhaps the most charismatic of Australian and Tasmanian wildlife, an appeal massively reinforced by the currency of its lateness, or in the case of those who persist in believing in an extant thylacine, its lastness. The last remaining wild thylacine was shot in 1930. The last captive animal died in Hobart Zoo on the 7th of September 1936. The precise date is significant, as the thylacine had been made a wholly protected species under Tasmanian law on the 10th of July of that year. So after around 3,300 years of us inhabiting the Australasian continent, 550 years of state-sponsored persecution were followed by 59 days of state protection before the species perished. And commenting on this irony, Amy Lynn Fletcher has traced the thylacine's uneasy relationship with contemporary Australia's sense of itself. That the Tasmanian tiger's demise dovetailed with the initial stirrings of Australian environmentalism, indeed with the stirrings of modern Australia, raises the costs and consequences of this particular species loss to an acute degree. In essence, the Thylacine still confounds and eludes easy categorisation. Its story bridges colonial Australia and modern Australia. It's the crucial pivot point between the European settlers' intense dislike of the rare and the weird, and a post-colonial Australia in which valorisation of indigenous species constitutes a vital source of culture and identity. As a bridge between the colonial and post-colonial, the Thylacine occupies both an iconic and an ironic place in Australian national culture. A memorial to the violence of colonial modernity, its eradication carrying a sobering echo of the catastrophe which befell the Aboriginal Tasmanians, the Thylacine also signifies a powerful post-colonial nostalgia. As Stephanie Turner has observed, Tasmanian tourism most often represents the Tassie tiger as a kind of absent presence. Much Thylacine representation, Turner says, indeed much of the ecotourism experience in general, transpires in the tension of a seemingly empty landscape. The tourist gaze is directed to sites once occupied by a Thylacine, or more tantalisingly, where one may continue to exist. As an icon of the contemporary conservation movement and de-extinction movement, illustrated by the project to clone a thylacine from DNA held in the evolutionary biology unit of the Australian Museum, which ran from 1999 to 2005, the thylacine also represents the anxieties and assumptions around lastness as a privileged currency. Official acknowledgement of the species passing only came in 1986, but that was punctuated by efforts to stimulate discovery of an extant specimen, such as Ted Turner's offer of $100,000 for living proof in 1984. And indeed, official confirmation of the thylacine's extinction did not deter everyone, illustrated by the Bulletin magazine's 2005 offer of $1.25 million Australian for proof that the International Union of Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources that pronounced the extinction had got it wrong. Lastness, then, is a particularly prized commodity. Yet even this commodification can be read against the narrative modes of Anthropocene Noir. Turner has deployed Jay Clayton's notion of genome time to engage with what she says is the open-ended ambivalence of extinction recuperation narratives. Encoded within DNA is a perpetual present. This is the assumption of genome time. Encoded within DNA is a perpetual present of all possible species variations which genetic science can potentially make legible, resurrect. For Turner, the fabulous notion of the DNA molecule as the essential unit of life is complicit in the mythologizing impulse of some conservation narratives, positing a technological fix for historical harms. Turner notes that while the extinction of long-gone species remains an undeniable ending, the endless reproducibility of DNA renders all extinction open-ended, potentially open-ended. As already noted, Anthropocene Noir is a narrative mode marked by open-endedness. Furthermore, like the detective narrative in which the victim is reconstituted only to be murdered again at the denouement, from the perspective of projects like that of the Evolutionary Biology Unit, the extinction event contains within itself the potential for its reversal in the clues residual in the extant DNA. So it's the extinct animal itself that will be the basis for its reconstituting, its reassemblage, the retelling of the crime, you could perhaps say. The fabled revenant thylacine, resurrected within the crucible of genome time from genetic material that is assumed to be waiting patiently somewhere to be discovered, represents a variation on the paradox of the bodiless crime scene. As the thylacine extinction narrative is absorbed by a pervasive form of post-colonial nostalgia which both longs for and abhors the pre-encounter biome, it perpetually returns as an unresolved tension in contemporary attitudes to species death. The presence of the thylacine detective in Hooper's narrative represents an ironic commentary on this deep unwillingness to let the animal go, and the complex uses to which the Tassie tiger has since been put, a nexus of conflicting narratives of cultural and national identity, violence and technological absolution, and biocommodification and ecotourism, into which the animal itself disappears. The common denominator is that each narrative which appropriates the Thylacine figures the animal as an object of pursuit, whether as an extant creature or a viable genetic remnant. For example, in Julia Lee's The Hunter, a professional hunter pursues a living thylacine on behalf of a biotechnology company intent on weaponizing its genetic heritage. Hooper inverts this trope by making the thylacine the detective in her narrative, pursuer, not pursued. She's able to explore the contingent nature of the competing narratives of the Tassie tiger. As an account of national and conservation narratives, Terence Tiger's liminality is emphasised by his status as detective. As an icon of extinction, he highlights the thylacine's spectral presence within these competing narratives of loss and recovery. The privileging of lastness represents a further irony, given that, as Carol Freeman has said, colonial Australia habitually pictured the thylacine as an animal in need of erasure, she puts it. In light of this, Hooper's animal detectives, and Terence in particular, also comment on the role of representation in extinction. In the late 19th century, the thylacine was in effect cast as a villain in the narrative of settlement. Between 1888 and 1909, the Tasmanian government offered a bounty for every thylacine killed. And Graham Huggan and Helen Tiffin have observed how the recreation of the thylacine as the Tasmanian tiger wrongly emphasised the danger it presented to domestic animal stock, hastening its extinction. By contrast, Terence Tiger is a benign, quasi-heroic figure and a perpetually reasonable, reasoning presence in Kate's narrative, patiently introducing his animal colleagues to the principles of empirical detection and reflecting ruefully on the iniquities of criminal behaviour, as well as the limits of the known and the knowable. Using a twig, Terence drew a rough sketch of the Siddle's floor plan in the dirt. He traced a stick figure lying by her stick bed, and all the old concerns flooded back. Was this fascination with true crime not slightly crass? A way of fetishising death, of making it as kitsch as possible? All too often, Terence weren't worried, this supposed analysis of the criminal mind had no methodology. We're just gaulish Victorians studying a hanged man's death mask. He drew a stick refrigerator. It was amazing how such a ubiquitous white good could look so sinister. Often murderers used their fridges, and yes, also their washing machines, for such grisly purposes. Terence's anonymised stick figure recalls Kate's commentary on the normalising iconography of the doomed girl in crime scene photography. The way in which victimhood becomes just part of the scene. Vulnerability becomes just part of the scene. His doubts regarding the fascination with the grisly details of true crime represents an ironic inversion of the deadly colonial characterisation of the thylacine as a bloodthirsty sheep stealer. Instead, he's cast as a kind of postmodern detective, patrolling the boundaries between order and disorder, truth and its obverse, while anxiously aware of the contingent status of any discoverable truth. The true status of true crime, rather than the thylacine of the colonial imagination here, is what's placed under erasure. Finally, the thylacine detective in Anthropocene Noir also juxtaposes the embodied death of an individual animal and the bodiless extinction of the species. That is, he makes visible the species relation that is occluded in any single animal death. When viewed in terms of extinction, individual animal deaths take on a kind of spectrality. When looking on the isolated death of an animal whose species is threatened by human activity, such as Jordan's midway photographs, do we also look on the death of that species? When we're looking at that picture of the albatross, what are we actually seeing there? Are we seeing a particular instance, an individual death, or does it somehow give us access to something more dispersed? Tom Van Doren has coined the term flightways to articulate this problem. Species, he suggests, are lines of movement through evolutionary time, embodying a genetic and behavioural heritage that is constantly, almost imperceptibly, in process. Any individual animal is therefore a single knot in an emergent line, is how Van Doren puts it. To see any particular animal is also to witness the times, plural, that animal ties together along its flightway. The species death is a kind of spectral death, both present and absent, like the counterpointing of the absent and present narratives in Todorov's schema of detective fiction. Extinction haunts any fatal encounter with a threatened species, an uncanny relation which is finally embodied in the last animal, wherever it may be. As the spectral hero of Kate's child's book, Terence illustrates the ambivalence between individual animal death and species death. This haunting is also, however, a beckoning. As an ironic hero, Terence gestures in the direction of what Ulrich Beck calls the cosmopolitan moment of global risk, in which a nascent politics of inclusion emerges out of crisis. The nature of global risk is, Beck says, that the distant other is becoming the inclusive other, not through mobility, but through risk. Timothy Clark also talks about this when he talks about people who enjoy a kind of a wealthy lifestyle in the developed world as spectral interlopers on the floodplains of Bangladesh, that we are all kind of in ways that we hadn't realised before, present to one another, even in our kind of physical absence, because of the crises that we are all engendering and living through. As simultaneously culprits, victims, and detectives in the moment of Anthropocene Noir, we cannot properly negotiate the dispersed, ironic nature of risk unless the species other is also included. As Rose puts it, humanity is an interspecies collaborative project. We become who we are in the company of other beings. Applying Rose here to Beck, I think we can discover in the cosmopolitan enlightenment of shared vulnerability, multi-species communities of risk. So as victim of an historical extinction, Terence Tiger represents the interspecies violence of colonial history. As animal detective, he indicates the need to account for crimes, ruptures in relationality, that are at the same time incalculable and urgently in need of recognition, and which occur in the context of the, to use Bruno Latour's phrase, the risky attachments that link humans and non-humans. Rose calls this the great unmaking of the possibilities of the future, that is also an unmaking of the work and care of the generations that have preceded us. In the context of this great unmaking of futures and pasts, the Thylacine Detective is an ironic, in some cases, in some ways perhaps an absurd, but I think a pointed retort to the incalculability of extinction, its totalizing meaninglessness, and highlights the concomitant need to rethink the risks that we all face. Thank you.